everybody. I'm Scott, and welcome to Shelfware. This time I've got Julie Davis, who is my co-host on the Good Story is Hard to Find podcast. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here and talk about this book.
Absolutely, absolutely. And let's see, you've got a blog, Happy Catholic. It's at happycatholic.blogspot.com. Mm-hmm. Which is a place I was visiting even before I met you.
That's so funny, isn't it?
It is funny to think back way on that. I remember there was a time when I realized that you and the Julie on SFF Audio were the same person. Happy Catholic and SFF Audio. They're just like, how did that happen? That was amazing.
Yeah, because it's funny because that's when I was doing a podcast called Forgotten Classics.
Yes.
And I think that Jesse, and maybe you had been listening to it, and I was just reading books. I mean, a little commentary, but I was reading books on there. And
yes.
I was using SFF Audio just to get audiobook ideas. And I was so honored that you guys even knew who I was and noticed. And then you were like, are you Happy Catholic? And I was like, what? You're Catholic?
That was crazy. Yeah.
So funny.
Oh, and then, yeah, here we are, what, 12 years later, 11 years later, having done almost 10 years of the A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast.
And I think it was longer than that I was ever so often being on SFF Audio.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Anyway.
And yeah, and since then as well, you've written some books, Seeking Jesus in Everyday Life. The latest one is Thus Saith the Lord. Really terrific books.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, of course. But I'll leave links to where they can find you, where folks can find you. So what did you bring us this week?
Okay, so this is my chance to talk about something that we could never talk about anywhere else since we're so Catholic, every other venue. I'm like, there is no underlying any religious anything in this book. But I love it so much. It's called The Best Cook in the World, Tales from My Mama's Table by Rick Bragg.
Oh, man. Yeah.
And it is
fantastic.
Amazing. It is an amazing food memoir, I guess is the genre. But and I don't know if you ever read any food-oriented books.
I'm trying to think in the past if I have. I don't think I've read anything like this before. And I really, really, really enjoyed it. The audiobook, I want to say, is magnificent. Yes. You know, there's just something about it. But I did get the Kindle version as well. And because, you know, there's recipes in there and I wanted to look at the recipes. But I haven't read anything like this. So it's really him telling family stories and connecting food to his family's past. Present and future. It's just fantastic.
Well, and I have to say, I've read a ton of food writing because growing up, really, I think you would say food was my family's religion, so to speak. And my parents, to give my quick little story on food, my parents grew up just in households with mothers who were not maybe the... I don't know. I think you would say they weren't adventurous. And on one side, maybe didn't like cooking much. And the other side was just, you know, regular American cook. So it was meatloaf and pot roast and macaroni and cheese and whatever it was when they were growing up. And then they got married and discovered, oh, look, here's all this other food out there. There's French food. There's Italian food. Because they grew up in the Midwest in Illinois and Ohio and places. So a lot of the things that maybe even on the East Coast at that time you would get, like common Italian restaurants and things, they didn't get. And so that's about when the Food of the World series came out from Time Life, which you can still find in used bookstores. And those are excellent primers on the foods of all these different countries of the world. And they had a whole series of different ones on American cooking regionally. And they every 90 days, whenever one of these showed up, we knew in our household we were going to just suddenly be eating Japanese food for a while, or we were suddenly eating. Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome.
I know. Mm-hmm. And so, Middle Eastern food, like Indian food, and they quickly found the ones they liked the most. And it wasn't Chinese food and it wasn't Indian food, but they would try all these things.
Very cool.
Yeah. And I grew up in Kansas mostly. And so doing that, they had to cook all that stuff at home because you couldn't really find it. I mean, yeah, cilantro.
Isn't that something? And that's something that's really changed, isn't it? You know, yeah. I don't know. Did you live in a fairly big town in Kansas?
No, we lived in a pretty small town on the out, about 20 minutes drive up the turnpike to Kansas City.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, yeah, I live in a medium-sized town now and, you know, Indian food and Chinese food. I mean, Pakistani, I mean, you know, Japanese noodles. There's restaurants for almost all that stuff, but, you know, fairly recent.
Right. And Dallas is where I live now.
Oh, man.
And of course, everything. Yeah. Different kinds of Pakistani food. You know, it's, I was talking to my dry cleaner the other day who turns out was a huge cricket star in Scotland.
Oh, how cool.
I was reading all the newspaper articles. So I'm like super excited because anybody who listens to the other podcast knows I love Indian movies and all this. So we were talking about that kind of stuff. But I said, oh, I've been to this Pakistani restaurant. And he goes, oh, that one's no good. Here's three others you should try.
Okay. Oh my gosh. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So,
that's something.
Yes. Yeah. Back then you couldn't find cilantro at the grocery store.
Uh-huh.
Fresh ginger was a real, you know, exotic thing.
Yeah.
And so they had access to, they'd go to Kansas City and buy, there was Molinas was a neighborhood Mexican grocery store that, you know, people would come in on Sundays with their own pots to have the menudo put in for the Sunday meal.
Hmm.
And Scamica's was an Italian market in Kansas City that was very authentic. So
wow,
those kinds of things were exotic.
How about that? Yeah, I can't say that I was adventurous or am still adventurous, although I've branched out a lot more than I used to. But my upbringing was a little bit odd in that my parents are both from New York City. So they both grew up in New York City, and then they moved us to Idaho, and I grew up in Idaho. So I was in Idaho from pretty much kindergarten all the way through high school. And not a super small town, I would say a medium-sized town.
Mm-hmm.
But our family traditions for food were, you know, fairly tame, I would say. You know, spaghetti, ham and cabbage, you know, kind of from an Irish background.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember some other things. There was always a pork dish that my mom made that I liked. Macaroni and cheese, you know, baked. Those kind of things that I still crave sometimes, and I have to call my mom. You know, I've got it all down now, but when I first started to crave them, I was like, hey, how do I make that? And she wouldn't always know. She would be like, well, I guess we need to write it down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like this person is in this story or this book, you know, with his mom, right? And she just cooked, and he's like, we got to write some of this down. And she, you know, she was like, well, why? You know, well,
yeah.
You need to be in a book.
Well, yeah, because since he was already an author.
Yeah.
And she was really ill in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't the first time. And he came to visit and he suddenly went, oh, my gosh. When she goes, we have no recipes written down.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
that's something we should all remember. Right. Yeah. I mean, just about our you know, folks, our parents and our grandparents. All the stuff that they have in them that, you know, we should be writing some of this down. This is my point.
I have a bunch of, I've already done that.
Good, good.
Because first of all, my mom had recipe cards and we'd copy stuff off of them and everything. But once the computer age started and I was using, at that time, PageMaker, now it's InDesign, because I do graphic stuff.
Yeah.
I just went, oh, I'll just put my recipe files in here. So I have different files for the desserts, the main dishes, the whatever. And I would add to them and they're indexed and all this stuff. So when the kids left for college, I gave them each a notebook, a binder that had these pages in them.
Oh, that's nice.
And as things would change,
really
I'd change it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started at one point in when blogging was the thing before Facebook, way back, which wasn't that long ago. And I had a cooking blog, which I still have, but I was kind of doing more on it. I can't keep up with these food bloggers who they're taking pictures, they're doing this stuff. It's kind of turned into the family repository for recipes. And so when the kids were away, they'd go, I don't have your meatloaf recipe. And yeah, it's very important that I get it. And so I would put it on there and everybody could see it. You know, I would link to it on Happy Catholic and stuff, but that's the place they go. And the other day I realized Rose was saying, I don't know how you make your oven fried chicken, which I grew up with. And I said, and I realized, I was like, I can't remember where I got that from, but I've made it so long. I suddenly was like the mother in the book who'd say, well, you take a chicken and you cut it up. Well, you just cut it up, you know, the way you cut a chicken up, which she already knows. But when I'm writing it down, and I was like, and then you get some flour. Well, I don't know, just some. And you put it in a cake pan with some salt and pepper and maybe some seasoning, whatever seasoning you want. I don't know how much, just put some in there. And then you dredge the chicken in it. And then you, I'm just like her.
Oh, that is so great.
Yeah. And so I realized, because I was like, the other stuff I could find, the oven fried catfish, the meatloaf, the this and that, that people, these are standards in our house. But it was so funny when I was doing it. Because so the book, since we've talked about food, but not the book, should I give a short summary?
Yes, please.
Of it?
Go right ahead.
Yeah. Basically, as I mentioned, Rick Bragg, his mother's in the hospital. And it starts off talking about, you know, she can't, the food is terrible. She says, nobody here knows how to use a salt shaker. And she finally can't stand it. She's got to get home and get to her garden and everything. And she gets better enough that she gets herself out of the house. And, he starts saying, we need to write all these down. And he starts with story, because in his family, everything comes with a story. And so it starts with his grandparents, his grandmother and his, I guess, great grandfather, who, the old man teaches the girl how to cook. And that's a whole sequence of stories about these two personalities clashing and coming together. And so it starts with the most basic foods for his people, which are from, is it North Carolina? South Carolina?
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, it's definitely the South.
Carolina Hills.
Right. It says, you know, Rick Bragg is from Alabama, it looks like. Says, you know, Bragg was born in the small town of Piedmont in northeastern Alabama and grew up in the small community of Possum Trot near Jacksonville.
Okay.
And that's Jacksonville.
Somehow the way you talked about
Alabama,
the hills.
Right.
Well, yeah. And so you can see he doesn't focus on that so much. What he's focusing on is the people, and these people, as he says, are my people, our people. And I love when he says that. They are extremely poor. And the work they do is some of the most basic work. He talks about his grandfather who goes to get his own father to teach this guy's new wife how to cook. And he says, you know, he is digging wells in red clay all day long and coming home and having no decent food to eat, and is literally killing him because he's starving, basically. And it gives you an idea of a whole different way of life. And so all the recipes in their family, of course, they all have stories for it. The mother's telling stories. Eventually there's an aunt in there who's also kind of filling in some stories. And it takes it from that beginning of the story of his family through up to modern times. And the stories are compelling, but they're always wrapped around the food somehow.
Absolutely.
And so then he'll give recipes, and even listening to the recipes, I mean, and the way he reads it, he's got this beautiful accent, and he's telling you the story. I always have some piece of this on my iPod now, just in case I want to listen to something like that.
There's just something about Southern writing too. I mean, he's got it. He's got the Kevorka, whatever that is that, you know, but it is just so pleasant to listen to, so pleasant to read. There's just something about that Southern thing.
Well, yeah, 'cause it says, So his mother was cooking for him. Mm-hmm. Can I read this little bit?
Yeah, please, please. Mm-hmm.
So she's out of the hospital. She was cooking for him. "It's done," she said after a while softly. But like dogs listening for thunder, we seemed to be able to hear those words for miles. She handed me a heavy ceramic plate minted 2 generations before I was born. The same one I ate from before I left to catch the yellow school bus across from my grandma's house. The plate has a faded cluster of red roses at its center and a thumbnail-sized chip in the rim. I cannot recall how the chip got there, so it must have happened before I was born, and maybe even before she was. I raised the lid of the old pot bubbling on the stove and gazed into a molten aromatic pool. Pinto beans and ham bone with hunks of lean ham, disintegrating fat, and luscious skin floating in the liquid that melted from the ingredients to form a lovely, translucent elixir on the surface. A pot of deep green collards, the liquor steamed away, waited on the back of the stove, next to a skillet of pale gold creamed onions, and a tray of crisp cornbread muffins baked with melted butter and bacon grease. "Well, now you're just showing off," I said.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's the only person
good,
I know.
Good sounding food too.
Yeah. It's the only person I know who can make pinto beans sound just amazing.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I just love how he presented those recipes, you know. So not only that, you know, you get that story and he says that, and then he goes in, okay, this is how you make those things that I just talked about. You know, pinto beans and ham. This is how it goes. You know, he says, this is what you'll need.
Yeah.
This is, you know, how to make it.
Yeah. And the way he writes the recipes is so good.
Yes.
That I enjoy listening to him talk about the recipes.
Right. I didn't realize that this existed, you know, this genre, I guess. You know, I'm used to a recipe being, okay, here's a list of the things you need, and then here's a step-by-step, right? But here it is, you know, so the very first recipe is butter rolls, right?
Yeah.
In the very first chapter, you know, what you're talking about is great-grandfather. It says, you know, so she is his mom. She has 2 methods for this. One a little harder, more traditional, and at least 150 years old. The other, much easier, is only 60 years old. It's new, she said. So, yeah. But there's these things, you know, she prepares her biscuit dough just as Jim did, you know, in the story that he just told, in the way he taught her mother to do it. But because she bakes every day, she keeps her flour in a 10-gallon can. And every time she bakes a pan of biscuits or needs other dough, she shapes a bowl of dry flour inside the flour can itself, pours her wet ingredients and fat into the depression, and uses the ends of her fingers to push the dry dough down and pull the moisture up the sides until she has just the right consistency. You know, this is not something I'm used to reading in a recipe, but I love it. I was just like, wow, that's fantastic.
And I look at that and think, sometime I want to try that with a huge bowl of flour, because I'm not brave enough to do it with my flour container, because I'd never heard of that technique.
Yeah, yeah. And it does say, but this is not something you want to try right away.
Right.
You run the risk of contaminating your flour.
Right.
Better for the first 20 or 40 years or so to use a clean, flat surface.
Yeah.
Awesome. You know, just
and
great.
That's, I had picked out her sweet potato pie because I thought, oh, a recipe. Because he always starts off with what you will need.
Yes.
And then how to cook it.
Yep.
And then he's, you know, so he's cooked the sweet potatoes. And then he says, mash them with a potato masher or a large spoon as my mother does. She does not own a blender and will not have one in her house. And if you gave her one along with a microwave, she would put the blender in the microwave and turn it on. When I get too feeble to mash something, I'll quit, she said. Yeah.
That is so good.
And I also like every so often he'll go, well, she's like, you can use like a canned biscuits or something, he'll say. And she'll go, well, that's all right for people who don't know what they're doing. And she looked at me a little longer than she needed to.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Oh, and what did he call those biscuits, the canned biscuits? Whop'em, right?
Yeah.
Whop'em biscuits.
You know exactly what he's talking about.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I just never heard him called that before.
Yeah, no, me either.
Oh, that is so good.
But this is full of great stories about people, and he's not really trying to tell you something about people. So there's different kinds of food writing like this. And since you said you hadn't read much of it, which I've read food writing ever since I was in college, high school, maybe, because my parents, liking food as they did, would buy books that had extra commentary in it. You know?
I'd be very interested in some of your favorites.
Okay, yeah. So I'll send you a more complete list, but just off the top of my head, I remember. So at that time, two American cooks who were just shaking it up, and they loved these people, is Julia Child. Of course, everyone's heard of her.
Mm-hmm.
And lesser known in general, I think, maybe is James Beard.
I've heard of him. Yeah.
You've heard of him. Yeah, because there's the awards now every year. But there didn't used to be. He was a food writer and he had a food column and he'd come up with food cookbooks. But he also wrote a story about him growing up, and it was much more food intensive than this. He really just talked about all the ways they ate food growing up on the West Coast. And but there's different variations of all those things. So Calvin Trillin is somebody who, he was a funny food writer. And I can't remember the time period he was super popular in, maybe the 70s, 80s, 90s. And he would write about food in all different towns around the country.
Interesting. And, so some of them are writing things that have recipes in them, and some of them are writing things about experiencing restaurants and things?
He was writing recipe books.
Okay.
But Calvin Trillin was just a food writer. He didn't write recipes. He was often writing.
Meaning he'd go to a restaurant and say, this was awesome.
Yeah, sometimes he'd just talk about going to a town and trying all the barbecue there.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes he'd just write about standing in line at the post office, waiting to mail some Wolferman's English muffins from Kansas City, which is where he was based. So he loved Kansas City food. But that's where he grew up. He lived in New York at that time. But waiting to mail the Wolferman's English muffins and thinking about the people from all over the country who were all mailing their regional food to people who were somewhere else.
Yeah.
So he'd write a column about that.
Cool.
He wrote a column about how he found a decent local place to eat when he was at someplace that he wasn't used to, because he was a regular journalist also. And so it was just, they were amusing but true to life kind of thing.
Very good.
Gumbo Tales is one that's really good, about somebody who moved to New Orleans, and she's got a different chapter on it through the book with no recipes on her experience learning about what food was like in New Orleans. So the Vietnamese food there, the Italian food there, the food at Mardi Gras, really interesting. And you get to know the place because you're getting to know the people who are making the food and eating it. Garlic and Sapphires, I think, is the name of the book by Ruth Reichel, who for a long time, she ran Gourmet magazine right before it died, and that was not her fault that it died. But before that, she was a food critic. Gosh, I think it was for the New York Times. So the whole book is about her learning to disguise herself and go in so she could get a good critical look at the food without them knowing who she is. So there's all kinds of stuff. I mean, there's tons of these books out there.
Oh, nice.
And they're just entertaining to read if you like reading about food and people.
Yeah.
This is the best I've ever read of any of those, though.
Oh, that's nice.
This is top.
These stories are really great. You know, one that leaps out to me was the Pie That Never Was chapter.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So the recipes included in this chapter are chocolate pie, toasted coconut pie, and buttermilk pie. So of course I had got to have some pie, but it was talking about a feud, and I'm not positive who the people were. It was Aunt Jo. There's a photo, right? So 1943. So there was just a feud with a neighbor.
Yeah.
And after the feud was resolved, the you know, she wanted to be friendly to the neighbor and try to repair this relationship. So she would make pie for the neighbor every week for a while.
Three pies a week.
Right? Yeah. And she would send them over. She said, kids, you know, her sons, bring these pies over to this neighbor that we've had a problem with. and off they'd go, right? And she'd do it, you know, for weeks on end. And then one time she ran into the neighbor, said, "Hey, how have you been enjoying the pie?" And he said, "What pie?" That was the best. Oh, my gosh. So she found out that her boys were eating the pie, not delivering the pie. That was something. For and weeks, said, no less.
Oh, yeah. And she said she had to admire their cleverness because she was sending the pies over, mm-hmm. not all together, but every few days.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't bring back the pie tins. They'd really thought it through. They'd wash them all up just like, you know, you would if they had uh-huh. gotten there and been
yep.
eaten.
Yeah.
And they would not bring them back until they had all three. So just the way you'd wait till the end of the week to send them all back.
Yeah.
And it was that is a great story.
It was just terrific. And so well told. I mean, again, there's this style, you know, Pat Conroy has this style that he tells, you know, you know, Pat Conroy often talks about difficult things, especially fathers. Right. But, but his Southern writing, man, it's just so good. And there's just something about it that I really love, and I should seek some more out.
Well, and I think one of the things that the pie incident reminded me of when you were talking about it is that there are a lot of hard things in this book, but they're never dwelt upon.
No, no.
It's always on a kind moment or a funny moment, an extension of, you know, common humanity from one person to another. And so this book could have been extremely gloomy. And I've read some books like that. Ruth Reichel, who I mentioned, the food critic, that book is very lighthearted. But she's got a couple of other food memoirs about growing up, and those aren't so lighthearted. She had a really difficult mother. And that the difficult grandmother in this book, who starts off as the girl, and winds up being the grandmother, she's a difficult woman, but it's not dwelt upon. It's just kind of mentioned as, oh, there's this aspect of her personality, and then they just move on to something else. And so you'll have things like the husband of, it would have been his grandfather, was in jail for something, and the mother's on her own. She has all these little kids, and they're essentially starving.
Hmm.
And there's nobody who's got anything that she can really ask of. And the two little boys get a job with, I think it's a somehow related person who's mm-hmm. got money. And they're helping him with his farm chores and everything. And they find a way into a smokehouse and are taking little bits of meat and stuff that they're like, oh, we found it in the road. It fell off a truck. It was roadkill. It was, and she knows like this chicken was not roadkill, but she needs it. So she just doesn't ask the question. And it's funny because it could be a tragic story about this starvation and want and privation, but what it turns into is a really funny story because they steal some pig's feet. And the man himself happens to come by for some reason that I can't remember. And he goes, oh, you're cooking pig's feet. And she's like, oh, crud. Okay, well, come on, sit down and eat. And he does. And he goes, oh, you having hard times around here? Because I noticed your pig has like 5 feet or something like that. Like, he noticed it was the wrong number of feet, and he knew he'd been missing something. And so every so often, then he'd drop off a little something for him to help him out.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But
that reminds me of the sweet potato story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell it.
Oh, so yeah. So the sweet potato thing is just, again, hard times, not knowing where the next meal's coming from. But this woman had a sack of sweet potatoes. And it just broke her heart every time her kids would ask her, you know, hey, what's for dinner, Mom? And she couldn't come up with anything, right? Mm-hmm. So finally one day she said, you know what? We're going to have pie for dinner. And the kids got really excited. They loved it. You know, oh, this is the best mom ever. So she made a sweet potato pie with the sweet potatoes. And then the next day she said, you know what we're going to have for dinner today is cobbler. And then they said, nothing but cobbler, nothing else? And she said, nope. And they were so happy, you know? So then she makes a sweet potato cobbler. So, but yeah, just hard times. And I have this quote highlighted that I think kind of permeates what you're talking about. It says, it was the notion that there are few hard times on this earth, few sadnesses that cannot be eased with good savory food. Not just solid food that could fill your belly, but food with taste that filled up something else. It was not an original notion, not a profound or poetic one, unless it was your belly and your soul. Love it. And I think that permeates this whole book.
Yeah, and I think that phrase gets mentioned again. Because part of the problem is when, at the very beginning, and I've heard of people like this, who the problem with the young wife who didn't know how to cook for her husband was that, well, for one thing, she was so stubborn. But the other thing was she just didn't care about eating. So she didn't understand. And it didn't mean that she had never had good food, because her sisters had they had fixed the box supper that she took that attracted the young man in the first place, where it was delicious fried chicken and stuff, but they wanted to get her out of the house and married, which is another funny story. But when the old man comes, he's just as stubborn as she is, but he manages to explain to her, he says, the main problem, other than attitude, was an almost total disregard for seasoning. Like a lot of people who are not eaters, or who eat mostly just to stay alive, she did not understand the importance of it. It was seasoning, the old man believed, that made the difference between living life and merely enduring it. It was not a profound notion. Well, maybe a little, coming from a man in hobnailed boots. He told the girl, in as few words as possible, that she had to think about what supper time and all meals really meant to working people. It did not just mean food on the table. It meant the backbreaking labor was done, at least for a while. These meals, dinner time, and especially supper time, were as close as most of them would come to a worldly reward. They ate supper early because they went to bed early to be up at 4 the next morning to do it all over again. The time a working man or woman spent hunched over a bland, dull plate was wasted, empty, disappointing time. The cure to that malaise was salt, black pepper, ground cayenne, pork, onion, garlic, cinnamon, vanilla, and more, and a few Yankee greenbacks to buy it all.
Wow.
Oh, to buy it all with. Mm. And these days, I would say we don't suffer from that so much as the other thing, which they've got because they aren't eating at restaurants or anything, is the lack of the family connection around the meal and somebody to cook a meal.
Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, takeout is one thing and going to restaurants is one thing, but a meal that somebody has cooked that you go, ooh, it's this, like you said, that pork dish.
Right, right.
Your mother makes that you crave sometimes.
Right.
Those are all worked in together with family. And he's talking about reward in a way that I don't understand, because I, thank goodness, don't have that backbreaking work and that dull life.
Yeah.
Where that's it.
Wow, there's really something to that. I mean, you know, it reminds me of Martha from the New Testament. know, I'm bringing that up like we're on the Good Story podcast. It gives you a new look at that story, doesn't it? Because it's, you know, it this weight of... or this meaningfulness, I don't mean weight, but this meaningfulness of what the meal is, you know, and it's like just
how important awesome. Hospitality is in the Middle East today was even more so maybe then.
Right. So now you're extending past your family to guests.
Right, right. And in my family, that's definitely how love was expressed. And it is how I express love. I'll make things that people want specifically, you know.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And you want to get it right.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Yeah. So right now I'm in the mode in my life where my daughter and sometimes my son lives farther away, but sometimes they'll come over for dinner, you know.
Neat. Yeah.
And that's always a special day. Trying to do it weekly, you know, but Sunday night usually.
Well, and we have an interesting multi-generational moment in our lives right now. It's a few years ago, my daughter Rose came home from LA, and we all realized because she's doing freelance work, she could just have her office in the house and she doesn't need to move somewhere and have the duplicate expenses for any reason. So that's fine. And then my mother, who's 86 now, came about a year ago from Florida to live here too. So when we sit at the table, it's not just me and my husband. It really is. We're representing what someone wanted to eat or cook. And everybody comments on, do they like it?
Mm-hmm.
Rose and I almost always will go, oh, this is the best one. Or, oh, you know what? Too much salt this time. Or, you know, if it's a new recipe, I wonder if we did this. And we'll make notes for next time. It's my brother-in-law joked that that because in the families of me and my brother and sister, we're all the ones who cook.
Coming
from the family we come from. Yeah.
Right.
And so I remember when my brother visited, he wanted to cook. So he was cooking and he has a different way of doing it. We just comment while we eat and talk about it. And we'd get partway through the meal and go, okay, so reactions, what do people think? And it was like taking a report. He goes, well, I think I would do this different. So we're all doing that. And my brother-in-law said one time that if you want to have something that we're making more than once, you say there's something wrong with it so we can fix it. We'll keep working on it.
Oh, and that's cool.
If you
that's
are tired great. Of it, you say it's perfect because you're never going to have it again because we perfected that.
That's you mentioned something. So just over probably, I'm going to say 6 years or so, I've been cooking more and more and more.
Okay.
And I have started to do what you just said, you know, like taking notes, like, okay, this time I did this and thumbs up, worked really good. Yeah. And noting that somewhere is something that's new for me.
Okay.
And I loved, you know, you and I have talked about some recipes in the past and you said something about a Grail Quest that I just love that idea. Talk to me about that. It's so great.
So, that's the thing where you have this mind's eye idea of the perfect, say, macaroni and cheese. And you're just like, well, this recipe's pretty good. But what do other recipes do?
Uh-huh.
And or how can I just fix this one a little bit? And there's just something small. And it, for me, that started because everybody loves meatloaf. I hate meatloaf.
Uh-huh.
It just was never anything special.
Gotcha.
People would say, we're going to have meatloaf. And I'm like, fine. And but I was like, you know, if everybody loves it, there must be a version that I would like also. So I just started trying meatloaf after meatloaf. And it wasn't, you know, it was just over time.
Uh-huh.
I'd go, oh, okay, I'm going to try meatloaf again. And oh, my gosh, have I found the perfect meatloaf out of James Beard's American Cookery. Holy moly.
Mm-hmm.
It is. First of all, tell me you're not going to like a meatloaf that's got breakfast sausage in it.
Oh, my gosh.
to help flavor the meat.
Uh-huh.
And then let's talk about the fact that you wrap it in bacon before you put it. You put it on a baking sheet so it's not sitting in a pan just getting soggy from the juices. You're putting it on a baking sheet so the fat drains away. But it's sitting on bacon and it's covered with bacon. I think we're talking about it's an American terrine, essentially, in that sense. And amazing.
That is so great.
Yeah,
that is so great. And that in this book, I think that bacon grease is the main ingredient, or it's an ingredient in almost every single thing. Yeah. Get your bacon grease and do this. Yeah.
Well, I grew up with a jar of bacon grease in the fridge. I mean,
uh-huh.
Didn't you?
No, I didn't. Yeah.
Oh, Scott.
I don't remember that at all. I don't remember a jar of bacon grease.
I think there was just, there was fat from a chicken, sometimes my mom would save it.
Uh-huh.
You know, you fry potatoes in it or something. Delicious.
Yeah. I apologize to my parents if I'm remembering incorrectly, but I sure don't remember that. I just don't.
No disrespect for cultures that don't say bacon grease. So Grail Quest. So then I never really thought of it that way, but it's either that or it's the thing where like I've made a chocolate cake and I was like, it was just out of a, I don't know, Betty Crocker cookbook or something, but it was so easy and so good and so always perfect. This chocolate buttermilk cake. And I was like, oh, this is the only chocolate cake I ever need to make. So it doesn't matter what recipe I'm reading. If it calls for chocolate cake, that's the chocolate cake I make to put in as the cake part. You know, I've got the, and I guess this is how you get the family recipes, right? For some people, it's just like, oh, this is the one mom made. This is the one I make. But for me, because I was discovering a lot of this stuff myself, because the thing I forgot to mention about my parents is because they loved all this new stuff, we never got macaroni and cheese, meatloaf, creamed chicken, whatever people grow up with normally. I had to go to my grandparents for that.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of those things I found on my own in terms of the recipes for them. So my potato rolls that I got out of this one cookbook, those are the ones for our house.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
The, you know, so.
Yeah. My wife makes rolls that are for her family recipe, and that's that's a staple. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's, and that's not a grail quest. That's just where you go, oh, I didn't have to ever look for another pancake recipe. Rose did it for sweet potato pie for a long time till she found hers. Lately, I've been thinking about my lasagna is not at all what I would like it to be. And you don't make lasagna tons, but I've been looking. Therefore, that's led me down an interesting rabbit hole of going, oh, look at all these different lasagnas the Italians have. Ham and mushroom.
Very
cool. Pesto and provolone. Oh. So I've been making some of those occasionally before I go, okay, time for lasagna again. I'm going to try putting this sauce that I like with these kinds of ingredients and using these noodles.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this, this, this book has prompted me to, you know, I love the food in it. You know, the food that they talk about is stuff that I like, you know, so, I made cornbread and chili. I don't remember a chili recipe in here. But there is a cornbread recipe, and it says to make it in an iron skillet, and I did that.
Yeah.
And, of course, it was good. And I love, you know, it says, you know, often in a recipe it says, okay, if you don't have an iron skillet, you can do this or that. But in this book it says, if you don't have an iron skillet, go get one. It doesn't give you the option. It doesn't say, this is plan B. Just go get one.
Yeah, and that happened to me when I moved to Texas. And I had Black friends who went at lunchtime. They go, let's go here. And that's when I first had soul food. I was like, oh, too bad my husband doesn't care for Texas cooking in that way. I'm like, oh, my gosh, red beans and rice, so good. Yeah. He's like, no, it's very frustrating. But that's where I first had cornbread that wasn't sweet like northern cornbread is. It's got almost no sugar, if any, in it. And you just get that corn flavor.
Interesting. Yeah, I think she said in here, don't add sugar to your cornbread or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the recipe I have, you don't add any sugar either.
Right, right.
And you add a little bit of white flour just to give it a little rising ability.
Yeah.
Or to kind of loosen it up a little bit. But you do cook it in a cast iron skillet. And I've tried cooking it in other things. And no, the skillet gives this crust that's really wonderful.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Yeah. And I agree. It came out so good. I was like, oh, well, this is something I clearly needed to know. You know, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another chapter that really leapt out to me was the poke salad chapter. I was like, what on earth, you know, so talk about hard times. But this is a weed or a vegetable that you actually need to cook correctly. Otherwise, it's not good for you.
It'll kill you.
Yeah, I just can't believe it. I was like, really? Yeah. Is there another analog to that?
I'm just thinking of people who go mushroom hunting.
Yeah,
of course,
okay.
You don't cook mushrooms one way or they poison you, but you have to know exactly which mushrooms to get, and people do it.
Yeah.
And I just read it and went, oh, okay, that checks out.
I'm sure it does. It's just it's a fascinating thing, you know. I always wonder, like, who was the first one to do stuff, you know? So who was the first one who said, okay, I'm going to cook this, but the way I need to do it is this because I don't want to die. It's like, really? Wow. Yeah.
Let's talk about the old wives' wisdom.
Yeah.
you know?
How does that happen?
The thing I liked about that chapter was it talked about the mother teaching the daughter about nature.
Yeah.
And what you could eat and couldn't eat and what was good for what and when to pick this thing or...
Yeah.
And just also the beauty of it.
Right.
These flowers, it's, you know, just pretty.
Yeah. And then, you know, I remember something in there talking about, you know, if you went to a rich person's yard, they would really get after you if you tried to take any of their vegetables. But the poke stuff, they would, they considered that a weed. So, you know, you could go take all that you wanted and they would thank you for that. Mm-hmm. So, but again, you know, there was another, you know, hard times type of a situation, you know, mm-hmm. where it's talking about that.
Well, it makes me think too, and these aren't necessarily toxic or anything, but it makes me think of the old custom that's not followed much of dandelion greens.
Mm.
Now you'll see them in super fancy restaurants where the dandelions are specially grown so they can harvest the leaves really young. But you can see when you think about when dandelions are sprouting out, gathering those young, tender leaves at that time of year when there's almost nothing green that you've had for so long because of winter, how refreshing that would have been.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's nettles, like nettle soup is an old English thing that some people would do in this country. And of course, nettles, those will sting your hands when you pick them.
Uh-huh.
So you have to wear gloves or have really tough hands. So they're a real thorny weed, essentially, but you cook them into a soup. You cook them for a really long time. So there's all kinds of stuff like that that kind of lingers on the sides of current American culture. But it's just if you read a lot of these books, you know about them.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah, I have a ton to learn. But love all the food in here. I would eat all of it, you know.
I did realize in our conversations in email about this book, I was like, wow, I know more than I thought I did because I'm kind of steeped in it without realizing it. It's like listening to you talk about computer code for making robots and stuff. Where I'm right. like, oh, I have to think about that. Oh, yeah. That does make sense. But this is where I'm like, oh, yeah.
Right. That's great. Yeah,
just,
I love it.
Well, I don't know. It's
yeah. What about, is there, do you have a favorite chapter or something that you return to? That hasn't been mentioned yet?
You know, one that I like that I don't think I liked as much when I was first reading it, I've read it now three times, is the one where his mother goes to work in a diner, essentially, I guess. Uh-huh. And it's talking about all the people, all the workers, the army people or the military people from whatever nearby place come to that place and to get good, decent food.
Mm.
And it's not like McDonald's food. It's cooked by somebody who cares about what he's doing, who wants to have his own restaurant. But here's how this food is cooked, and here's the food they supply, and here's all the people who are mingling in there because they're eating that food.
Wow. Yeah.
And about her working there. And it hit me this time through just thinking, you know, that's such a common scene to have in a movie or a book or something, but here talked about just from the point of view of the people who are working there and eating there because of the food, without being foodie.
Right, right. Know. Yeah.
You realize the value of good, basic nourishment and the pleasure it brings. And again, I guess for me, one of the big things is it's in these big scenes, it brings you together. And then the other scene, this is just so great. This, when his mother's father dies, uh-huh. And they are two little girls together at that funeral. I don't know if you remember that or not.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and everybody is preoccupied. The men come first, and they're viewing the body, and they're sorry, and they're all crying, and, you know, all this kind of thing, and telling stories. And then the women come later, because they were all home cooking.
Mm-hmm.
All these people came.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It says, it's talking about they're moving because they have all these big platters of meatloaf and fried chicken and roasts and biscuits and cornbread and pots of pinto beans and black-eyed peas and skillets full of fried potatoes and all that. And then all these desserts and coffee pots. And I was like, yeah, this is how you celebrate a life and a community.
Uh-huh.
What this life meant in the community. And it's they're celebrating it through offering something that's going to help ease the grief at that moment. because you have to eat. And then the two little girls, the, his mother and one of her sisters, they can't eat. They're so grief-filled. And they're there in the middle of the crowd, and people keep bringing them food, but it keeps getting left on the side table. They just can't even eat it. And some kind woman, I think it's she notices, or is it the husband? He notices, and he goes to get his wife, and he goes, they're not going to eat, not with all those people here, not with their daddy in the next room. And so they take him home, and she cooks some cubed steak and biscuits, which is another thing I'd like to make. But it's, but it's, you know, smelling the food, being out of the environment for a little while with people who are just being kind to them. And she's like, I realized suddenly I was so hungry. You know, it's food is wrapped up in everything to do with our lives. And when we think of it just as sustenance, which sometimes you do, you're on the road, you stop at a McDonald's, you just got to get somewhere. That's natural too. But there's so many moments when it's wrapped up in the stories of our lives. And it was funny because didn't you tell me that when you read this book, you went and asked your parents about their food stories or growing up?
I was curious about what they ate growing up, you know. So my mom really passed that stuff down to us, so her stories were the same as what we had. But on my dad's side, my dad was Swedish, right? 100% Swedish. So he he started to talk to me about some things that his dad used to make. Crop corker. He says, chop ham into small cubes, chop onion into small pieces, fry ham and onions in butter with allspice, boil potatoes, mash, let cool, no milk or butter, shape potatoes into hamburger-sized patties and stuff with ham and onions, and then heat the patty in a frying pan when you want to eat it.
That sounds great.
Yes. So that's a great Swedish treat or snack, and that's something that his dad used to make.
Please put the recipe somewhere.
Okay. It's a very general recipe, but I will. I'll send it to you.
Yeah, that's the kind that if, and I think that's the value also of having cooked some. Even if what you're doing is, you know, not just follow the recipe for a while, but make enough foods, cook enough meals. You get a sense eventually. It's funny because my brother and sister tend to cook without using recipes. Very much. And when they do use them, at least this is the way they've told it to me before, they follow them slavishly. And my father cooked, he would use recipes, but it would kind of worry him. Eventually, he just cooked without them a lot of the time. But my mother and I always use recipes, and Rose does this too. And I don't know about Hannah, what she does. I'll have to ask her. But when I follow a recipe, I almost never follow it exactly. Unless I just can't taste on my mind's palate where we're going. I almost always will go, well, this seems like it would be easier. I don't really care about that garnish. I know a quicker way to do this. I know what they're getting at here. And so then I just don't let it hold me down in that way. You know, cakes are one thing sometimes.
Yeah, I tend, you know, like if it's the first time I've made something, I follow it pretty darn close. But as I return to it, I find that I do alter it, and you know, like chili is a good example of something that's evolved, and I have a chili that I really like now, but it's not what it was when I started, you know. You know, so, you know, this is probably, you know, what, like the 15th time I've made it over the last, say, 6 years or so. And I've got it to a spot where I like, I really like how it comes out. So I try to keep repeating it now. But I do it every single time. I'm like, about like this, about like that. I'm to that point on that recipe. But if I'm doing something I haven't done before, like I ordered a box of seafood from Alaska. I don't know if you like seafood, but you know, there's going to be some salmon and some other stuff in it. And I'm excited for that to come because this is going to be brand new for me. You know, when I saw it, I was like, yeah, I want to try that. So I've never cooked salmon. So I'm going to have some of that, and I'm going to get to try things. And,
I am going to send you my, or put, give you a link to my, it's just roasted salmon in the oven, but there's this horseradish sauce that goes with it.
Wonderful.
So
yeah.
Easy.
Please do. Yeah. So I'm really getting into this idea, you know, and I love your Grail Quest thing. It's now something that I'm going to do, you know, it's like, I'm going to find the best, you know, salmon
it
recipe or whatever.
Life more interesting. Yeah. I have to say fried chicken is another thing that it's a Grail Quest I've just begun, where I followed a recipe fairly exactly and went, no, that wasn't what I was looking for. And it's not like fried chicken is that hard, but it's, do you marinate it? If you do, what do you put it like? Is it in buttermilk? Is it in milk? Do you not do it at all? Do you just dip it in flour? Do you cook it in lard, oil? Do you deep fry it? The answer to that is no. You skillet cook it.
Right.
But, you know, so it's all these things. And it's just kind of interesting. And it's like, we're not going to have fried chicken that often, but it's something that we're going to have because I'm going to have it on my radar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just fun.
It is. And I've discovered it over the last several years.
I'm so glad.
Yeah.
That is neat.
Yeah,
and if you
really
get a great recipe, you send it to me. We'll put it on Meanwhile Back in the Kitchen.
Wonderful.
We'll put the Scott tag on it, and then you can have your family looking at it if you want.
Of course. That's a really cool idea. I love it.
Use it as a thing, and we get your recipes, too.
That's fantastic.
You know.
Very good.
I know, because it's funny when you said that, because I was saying that to the family, and they were like, oh, that's funny, because the kids are saying, you know, we grew up knowing the stories of how your parents cooked and how you never got these things. And Tom would talk about picking crab for gumbo when his family would go stay in Galveston for a week for vacation.
Yeah,
and his mother she didn't really love cooking. And she, of course, not really recipe book, learned it from her mother. So they had seven different meals. Sometimes she'd vary it, but seven meals, and they each came on a specific day of the week. So, you know, if it was Tuesday, you were getting something that was, you always knew.
Right.
And there was, but on Saturday, they would always have hamburgers and they'd always gather around and watch, I don't know what, on TV together. And one day she just got a wild hair and she cooked hamburgers on a Tuesday. And Stevie, his little brother, was like, well, went over to sit in front of the TV with his plate. And he's like, they're like, oh, that's not on. He goes, but it's hamburger day. Of course it's on the TV.
Of course it's on. Yeah. That's cool.
That's how regular hers was.
Yeah. But so I thinking about that, I think that was possibly a negative effect of moving so far away from where they were from. Is I definitely lost some of that family connection. Especially with my dad's side of the family. I mean, we would see people from my dad's side of the family. It wouldn't be annually. It would be 4 years, you know, some wedding or something, you know, something would happen, you know, that there would cause that. And even then, you know, sometimes we wouldn't all go. My mom's side of the family, she was in a pretty small family. You know, so it was her and her brother and then her mom and dad. We saw them fairly often.
Okay.
So on that side of the family, there was a real tight connection. We probably saw them annually. But my dad's side, who lived in New York City, we just didn't see a heck of a lot.
Yeah.
And his parents passed away when I was really young. And my mom's parents were alive all the way through high school, you know. The big difference there.
And that makes such a difference, too. Although, because our grandparents were alive, I was in maybe married or in college before the first one died. So, but we didn't necessarily see him tons. But the other funny thing is, one set we didn't see very much, and the other set we saw very frequently because they didn't have any other kids than my dad. So they actually, once my grandfather retired, they would move to be near us. So they moved to Kansas when my dad moved to Kansas. And this was in a time when, you know, when you were upwardly mobile, you're moving and changing jobs all the time. So we moved a lot.
Yeah.
And so our family was fairly insular that way too. But they didn't cook for my parents. They were really intimidated. It was, that's really kind of too bad, I think. So when they would make us chocolate pudding and all these amazing things, Jell-O with fruit in it and whipped cream on top. Oh my gosh. Did you know you could eat that as a salad? What? That was great.
Oh, and, my gosh.
And they were also adventurous in the sense that we were the first kids I knew who had Pop-Tarts. They saw them on TV and went, let's have these for breakfast.
Oh, wow.
So they would buy us all the newest things. They were buying Tang when it came out, and they were trying everything.
Oh, man.
They had such a happy, adventurous look at life, but they knew the way my parents cooked, and they loved eating it, but they weren't going to cook for them.
Gosh, I remember the first time I had biscuits and gravy for breakfast. I was sleeping over at a friend's house. I must have been, I don't know, 12, I had a sleepover. And I got up in the Sunday morning, and they're making biscuits and gravy. I'm like, what? What is that? And bam, instant. It was like a revelation. It was like a shaft of light from heaven.
Oh my gosh.
So good. Yeah.
You know, you say that, and I'm thinking, I had them first when I was an adult, and I think I've only really had them in restaurants, and I just feel a new grail quest coming on.
Oh, man. That is a grail quest for me, too.
Yeah.
My gosh.
I love good biscuits and gravy. Although I don't want to do it with smoked sausage. I like breakfast sausage, but
very nice.
I think I don't like eating breakfast, big breakfast, really.
Uh-huh.
Although I tend to eat leftovers for breakfast. I like duck, but I like breakfast food for dinner.
And that fried egg sounds
amazing as a dinner.
Yeah, breakfast food is. I don't know. I love it. I really love it.
My poor husband. Yeah. This is why we have breakfast for dinner a lot of the time, because I'm not cooking breakfast. So.
I love it.
Yeah. Wow.
In this book, this kind of ties into what we're saying. I have another quote that I'd really like to read.
Yeah.
And it's really near the end. It's right after he did a turkey recipe.
Mm.
It said, "It is the simplest recipe I have ever seen or even heard of. It may be, of course, that it is no better than other turkeys I've had in my lifetime. It may also be that simple, even simple excess, is just better. I guess if I was just going to be honest, this notion is at the heart of most of our food. I see it now. I guess I figured that when I went back through these pages and counted the number of times that one stick butter was the measurement we used, except in this one where it was 1 pound. I guess some cooks might even see that method as clumsy or the like. As a man who has failed even at carrying food, let alone at cooking it, I believe now and always will that what my mother and my people do in a kitchen is nothing short of beautiful, and I get to say."
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So good. But that kind of ties into what you're saying. It's like there's a place for all the complicated stuff too, but the simple stuff too. Simple is good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd have never had pot roast if it wasn't for my grandmother.
Uh-huh.
Right. They didn't even make pot roast, man. We had Sauerbraten regularly, which is German pot roast.
Right, right.
So it's different.
I love it.
But yeah, biscuits and gravy. Oh, man, my mouth is watering.
Heck yeah.
But yeah, this book is, of course, we've talked about food, but hopefully enough about food and stories to see how it plays into something that you don't have to care about food for.
Right.
But even if you don't care about food, we both read things out of recipes, so you can see that those have their own personality too.
And again, if you're into audiobooks at all, I highly recommend the audio version of this. It was just so good.
It's fantastic.
So pleasant to listen to. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really great. And lots of recipes. I've got to try the pineapple upside down cake and definitely some of those pies.
The
cube steak, and even things like hamburger steak with brown gravy. It's like, now I really want to make that.
Yeah.
Let her rip.
It's funny because I've read it 3 times. I've made 1 recipe out of it, and that's only because I remembered it when I was doing corn on the cob, but I suddenly realized I was using my one big Dutch oven suitable for corn on the cob for something else that I couldn't change. And I was like, what am I going to do? And I'm like, I've read 1,000 recipes about cutting corn off the cob and, you know, cooking it up with some butter and stuff. And I went, hey, there's one in here.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm. So I just kind of, and it was kind of what I had in mind, but I just kind of used it as my guideline and yeah. went, oh, okay, got it. And it was delicious. Everybody was just like, this corn, it's so fresh. And after doing that a couple times and also making this fresh corn salad, I suddenly went, oh my gosh, I've been lied to. I was lied to about green beans when they went, frozen green beans are just as good as fresh.
Hmm.
I rediscovered fresh a few years ago and went, that was such a lie. Now I can't use frozen. And the corn, I was like, you can really work and find a decent frozen corn, but really you might as well just save it for the corn on the cob.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
cut it off the cob and use it. It's a lot of work, but oh, it's so worth it.
Oh, that's great.
And that's the simple, but you might have to do the work.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
and
you
might work have to grow good.
Tomatoes or whatever.
Work is good for us. Right.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You're right. Mm-hmm. It is good for us.
Yeah.
And it gives the satisfaction of achieving something bigger with what you've worked on.
Mm. Indeed. Yep. Well, terrific. Thank you so much for bringing this book. This has been so fun. I loved it. I really enjoyed this book.
Oh, it's a keeper.
Goes on the, goes in the pool room.
Get the real version. Yeah, the pool room. So everybody needs to watch the castle.
Yeah. To find out what the pool room is.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you.
The family's in there in a different way, too.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, good. Good, good, good. Well, thank you again so very much for being here.
Scott, thank you for having me. We would never have talked about this book otherwise, I think.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
I think it would have fit just fine over there, too.
I actually, now that we've talked about family so much, yes, it would have. But we talked about it here, and we'll just have everybody come here to your new podcast.
You bet. Sounds really good.
And if people are listening to this who don't ever listen to that other podcast,
you
know, we're not all about, you know, hallelujahs and amens over there. It's a lot like this.
Yeah, it is a lot like this. In fact, this would have fit in there just fine.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's a good story. It's hard to find. Yep.
Yep.
Find it at all your podcast places.
So. Yeah, there's plenty to choose from. I think we have 240 episodes right now.
For sure. Yeah. I love it. All right. Well, thank you again, and take care.
Yeah.
Say hi to everybody at dinner tonight.
I will.
All right.
Have a great day, Scott. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.